This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Identity Crisis, the quest for self-knowledge in speculative fiction.
So this episode is rather topical.
Yeah, we're obviously the scope of a single hour-long episode is not big enough to really get into the weeds on some of the issues, but obviously unless you've been completely living under a rock for the last few weeks, you'll have noticed a lot of things in the news, and a lot of these things have their roots in identity. We will go into a bit more about how that is, but certainly issues such as the Black Lives Matter movement, which has obviously gained traction and absolutely should do, and then obviously some the issues surrounding certain comments made by a certain well-known author regarding the trans community. And again, all these things have their roots in identity. And okay, Jules's opinion here, and you know, I'm putting this as mildly as I can because I don't want to go into the point where I start ranting and swearing for 10 minutes. Nobody needs to hear that. That's what I have a boyfriend for. Basically, that the idea that anyone would try and deny someone else the right to self-express, to have their own identity, is absolutely absurd, because the quest for identity is a human issue. This is something everybody experiences to some extent, with varying degrees of difficulty and with varying variables, funny enough. So to say, you know, that someone else's experience, because it falls outside the received norm of parameters, is ridiculous. And I'm having difficulty getting my head around how some people cannot get their heads around that.
Yeah. Particularly for me, two things on that. With regards to J.K. Rowling's sort of comments, the bit that really got me was the idea that that people having the identity of being, you know, trans, somehow erased, was apparently erasing cisgendered women's identity, which is ridiculous. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And it was the idea that, yeah, one is therefore encroaching on the other. That really, really annoyed me. And another thing that really sort of comes into it is the question of labels. And a lot of people, you know, saying, why do we need labels? Why do we need things like that? Or for, you know, people who are part of the Black community who have friends who say, I don't see colour. I don't see colour. I don't see you as Black. And the problem with that is that words and labels are very important because they are part of navigating your identity. To say, I don't see you as Black, or why do we need labels, is to rob someone of their identity, or to ignore that part of their identity, which is ultimately incredibly harmful, even if it's coming from a place, you know, a well-meaning place.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of us at some point will have fallen down that particular crevice.
Yes.
Because, you know, we're human and we will make those mistakes, and hopefully we then educate ourselves and we don't make the same mistakes twice. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I would love to be at a point where we could all say, you know what, we don't actually need labels because everybody is equally accepting and tolerant of everyone else, and nobody is fazed by the idea that someone might have a different set of norms. We're not there.
No.
We're quite a long way off being there, unfortunately. So it doesn't matter how accepting you as an individual are. We do still need the framework at the moment. And I think the problem is, whenever you get somebody, even if they mean it quite well intentionally, if there's someone with a platform so big that they should have basically their own little morality officer, their own ethics officer, to manage whether they say anything or not, just because they could accidentally weaponize sort of 1,400,000 people or more, 14 million probably, that's more like it, I think. That's really an issue. You've got more power than you think if you are a public person, and the more you are public, the more power you've got, and you've got to be so careful with it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my feeling. I will say, and I'm not defending anyone here, I have read her letter explaining, because obviously tweets don't really do things justice. No. And I genuinely think she is not capable of understanding.
Yeah.
I think she genuinely in her own head is well-meaning, but she is not capable of understanding at the moment, and perhaps she doesn't really want to.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with what she said. I do really want to make that clear. I don't agree.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right, and I think the problem is that she's centering it very much on her own kind of mindset, her own experience, and she doesn't want to change that. And something that really annoyed me was that there's this idea that identity can be interchangeable within certain groups. So, you know, she says, oh, I can defend what I'm saying because I have a butch lesbian friend who agrees with me. And I said, yes, okay, so being a lesbian, that's part of someone's identity. But being a lesbian does not mean that you are actually privy to the experience of being trans. We're part of the same community in terms of the queer community, but it's a very different experience. It's a very different identity. There's not crossover, not as much crossover as that, whereby saying, oh, well, my lesbian friend agrees with me, automatically means that you're right about trans experiences.
No. I mean, I think she was coming from the position of my lesbian friend agrees with me in the sense of female biological bodies, and I'm not going to get into the weeds on that.
Yeah,
because it's just it just the whole thing makes me feel kind of sick in the sense of that she would throw that out there.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right, and you cannot take one part of a minority or a marginalized group and say that person is a monolith and speaks for everyone in that group. I cannot speak for all bisexuals. Madeline can't speak for all bisexuals. No. Either. Our experiences are vastly different because there's a generation gap.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually another example of it, which I sort of want to give, which came up recently that I thought was actually quite good, was, don't know if you've seen the film Bend It Like Beckham.
Yeah, I really love that.
there's this one scene, and I saw this argument unfurling, whereby there's this one scene where the female character, I haven't actually seen it, I can't actually remember all the characters' names, but there's one of the female characters who's getting very angry because someone has called her a packy.
Yes.
I'm now just going to say that as the P word. Someone has just said, called her the P word. Incredibly offensive. The thing is, it's normalised in Britain. It really shouldn't be. It's very offensive. It's not short for saying someone is from Pakistan at all. So they've just shouted that, and there's a male character who's kind of trying to calm her down, and she's saying, "You don't understand what that feels like," and he says, "I do. I'm Irish. Of course, I understand." And there was this huge outcry in response to this, saying, "No, you don't understand. You're Irish," and etc. And this came very much from audiences in America, who got very, very annoyed with the idea that an Irish person could be saying they understand the experience. And I really wanted to point out, and someone replied saying they were pointing out, which is that an Irish American had a very different experience during that period of time to someone who was born and raised in Ireland during the violent period.
Absolutely. Or someone who grew up Irish in England during that time.
Exactly.
Like me, I was sent to a school where I was given elocution lessons to remove an Irish accent so that I wouldn't sound Irish. Mm. I was told not to tell people where I was from. I was told not to tell people who my family were. My dad did not talk about the fact that my mother was Irish when he went to work for a government body, because they would not have taken him on.
Yeah.
Alan had a very similar issue as well. His mother used to work for GCHQ, and when she came back off leave, they said, "Well, you've just married an Irishman," so they sacked her. Mm. So I don't think people understand, and particularly, sorry Americans, but you really don't understand. I'm not saying it's the same, but sort of the marginalisation process is similar, and I only got a very mild dose of it.
Yeah. And during that period as well, I mean, to be, if you're sort of within Ireland and the violence was there. I mean, and this is very typical things of certain people not being allowed to get on buses, certain people being shunned, certain people being attacked, gangs roving, bombs, terrorists. You know, there were these extremes, people dying, people getting beaten, people getting attacked, people having their homes broken into, entire days which were completely, you know, where families would go away because violence was likely to be incited. These things were very real, and that was the experience of a small group of people, and I say small in terms of the whole wide world, of people who were Irish in the United Kingdom and Ireland during that particular time. And that is a part of the identity. Now, the whole point of the argument, as again, I haven't really seen the whole thing, was that this boy was saying, I understand what it's like for someone to use a slur against you to try and incite you into violence. Of course I understand that, and I understand how hurtful it is. Now, I quite liked that scene because this was a case of empathy being used, but not a case of someone's identity being erased and saying, well, I have it just the same as you. And I think the problem is that a lot of American audiences saw that and felt like, particularly people of colour in America, black Americans turned around and said, there's been lots of people who say, oh, but the Irish had it really bad in America. Failing to understand that, yes, historically there was great mistreatment of Irish individuals in America, but currently the system which is in place doesn't affect them in the way that it still does black Americans and people of colour in America, where it's still very much stacked against them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And during the 80s and early 90s here and before that, being Irish in Britain was not great. Mm. That's putting it mildly. This was obviously down to the Troubles, and we can't really get into that because that is a huge, huge topic that's really difficult to unravel. Mm. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. The fact is, it's not saying, well, my minority is as badly off as your minority. Mm. And I suppose part of what they objected to is he is a perceptibly white individual, even though he was white ethnic other. Mm. Saying, you know, I understand how you feel. Well, actually, I do understand how you feel. I just don't have some of the same selection issues that you have any more than you have the same as mine. So the empathy thing is really important. Mm. It doesn't erase that particular identity.
No.
I think there was another part in the film that I thought was really good, and that was when Keira Knightley's character challenged her mother. Her mother basically said, look, can you just tell me if you're dating, I think it was Nishira is the I want to say the middle Asian character. I can't remember the actress's name. And Keira Knightley turned around and said, Mum, I'm not a lesbian. Just because I don't want to wear makeup and I like sports, it doesn't make me a lesbian. But even if I was, would that matter? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's the assumption once again that being a girl or being female means that you must adhere to a certain set of norms. And again, that was something I understood really well, because it was a case of, no, you're clearly not a girly girl. You want to play with the boys and you want to play football and you want to run around and make lots of noise and climb trees and get dirty. Mm. And that's not something girls do. So you are not girling correctly.
Yeah. And this is a big part, because being a woman, you know, that is a part of everybody's identity. And there are certain things that sort of experiences that are relatively universal with women, about the way that kind of society treats us. But the thing is, it's incredibly nuanced because, and this is the point we're going to sort of really get into, no one thing makes up the entirety of your identity.
No, absolutely not. When we talk about identity, we're talking about a very nebulous concept, and it can incorporate or not incorporate various things. So interests, prime characteristics, you know, your nature, as it were, the things you lean more towards. Other people's perceptions of you can really influence it. That's particularly for females as well. your own internal narrative, how you see yourself, and the jarring contrast, the cognitive dissonance between how you see yourself and how everyone else sees you can feel like such a huge imposition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's before you get onto race, religion, culture, sexuality, gender identity.
Yeah, and it's also the other thing is that we fail to understand, not fail to understand, but sometimes we forget that there's lots of other things which really contribute to identity, which are completely beyond our control, which is what is our, you know, family situation like? Whether you're a single child, whether you have multiple siblings, whether you were put into a position of responsibility from a young age, whether both parents were present, whether you had same-sex parents, whether you had a single parent, whether you had an abusive parent, all of these things contribute to your identity growing up. Which is why you could have, it would be stupid to say, oh, we've got two people, they're both lesbians, therefore they're the same. Just because they share that one particular aspect, they could come from completely different, you know, backgrounds, 100%, and really have incredibly different views and a very different concept of their identity.
Absolutely. And obviously my experience growing up is completely different to yours. Not least because there's 13 years of difference in our age, and things changed drastically during the late 90s and onwards.
Yeah.
There was obviously little bits of change coming on before, but I think when you really start to notice it is when you sort of hit that puberty type age and you realise that there are impositions on you, and then you start to grow up and you see things moving around you and changing. And I think this is where you get people who get to the point where they say at a certain age, I never had things so good at your age, etc., etc. Forgetting that when they were, you know, 16 or 13 or whatever, yes, the world was ending because those were the things that you should be concentrating on at that particular time.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter. Nothing's ever going to be perfect. There's always room for improvement. So,
yeah.
I suppose, there's a lot more margin for self-expression in certain areas. But I also find, in my opinion, probably because, you know, I didn't grow up with the internet, just to tell you how old I am. we didn't have a home computer until the year I went off to university, and I never really used it because I was off at university. I self-taught everything I know about computers because there wasn't really a proper computing class at school or at college. So this is a case of I didn't grow up bombarded with social media, so perhaps I grew in ways in terms of confidence and self-image that other people aren't going to have the opportunity to do now because they're bombarded constantly with things like Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah. And then on the flip side of that, however, in terms of information, particularly for minority groups, which are a core part of understanding who you are, it's never been better. You know, I'm not saying it's the best, but it's never been better in terms of understanding certain things and being able to figure out who you are. You know, you no longer have to spend long, you know, years worrying that you're broken, because there is information which is easily accessible in ways that it wasn't before.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So the point that we're trying to make is that identity is complicated, and each of us, you know, are shaped by the experiences that we have. And sometimes our own identity can be very nebulous, even to us. And I think every day we're figuring stuff out about ourselves. And part of what sort of helps us to grow as individuals is that journey, which is probably why the quest of identity is such an intrinsic part of our storytelling.
Definitely. I've always thought that identity is important because until you understand who you are and, you know, relatively where you came from, it's impossible to make peace with yourself. And therefore, you can't set healthy boundaries with other people because you don't know what your own boundaries are. So it's an important thing to learn. People who have a strong sense of identity generally are people who are comfortable with the fact that they don't know everything about themselves yet,
yeah,
and they're okay with discovering. A strong sense of identity doesn't mean you've got it all figured out. This should not be a cake that's ever done completely baking, I think.
No, I completely agree. But I think that, I mean, for instance now, something that is kind of becoming a lot more common and sort of is the idea of going to counselling and stuff like that. And you see a lot more, but, you know, it used to be this extreme thing, you know, and whereas now it's a lot more normal. It's become a lot more normalized. And I think quite a few, you know, people at university will at least at some point speak to somebody, and, you know, one in three people suffer from, some kind of, mental illness at some point. So, you know, whether that be depression, anxiety, etc. So it's become a lot more normalized. And a big part of kind of the psychology that's being explored is about understanding trauma, is basically going backwards and sort of unpicking how it happened. Which I think for me is basically, it really speaks of that ultimate quest of identity and saying, why am I like this? Why do I constantly get angry about this kind of thing? Oh, I can pin it back to this particular moment. And it also goes to show that identity is something which changes over time, with experience, with understanding. Someone could really rapidly change after a very particular experience. So, you know, you could feel very strong in your identity, you know exactly who you are, and then have something horrifically traumatic happen to you. And then that becomes part of your identity. It becomes part of who you are. So identity is not static. It grows and develops and changes. It's something that continues, and that's why you can continue to search for identity, because identity is not standing still. It's like the worst hunt in history.
It is a constantly moving target.
Yes, it's hide and seek, but identity is cheating.
Yeah, it's seeking the unicorn. It's kind of being comfortable with the fact that you might never really lay your hands on it, but you find out a lot along the way. One final caveat before we get into the actual discussion on how this works in speculative fiction. I had a phoning moment the other day where I was talking to one of my other writing buddies, Michelle, mm-hmm. and saying I had Spotify on sort of random, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh my god, it's picked one of my anthems from when I was 16. Like, clearly 16-year-old me has got hold of the playlist. And then it went back in time. I was like, okay, now it's 14-year-old me. This is really disturbing. Because all these things were kind of reminding me of the people I used to be, kind of thing. You know, they make up who I am now, but they're people I used to be. And then it got to 18-year-old me. And I'm like, well, that's it then. No one's getting past this bit. That's it. She will kill all the others. Because Michelle had it in her head that there was some sort of, like, non-celebrity death match going on between the ghosts of Jules's past. Which is hilarious and also potentially a book idea, but very disturbing. And it occurred to me that, yeah, to you and to a bunch of other people, I make a lot of jokes about, oh yeah, well, I wouldn't have cared about that at 18 because I was just this stone-cold bitch who didn't care about anyone. The thing is, I'm not actually joking. I really was like that for a while. This is someone I used to be. This is someone I'm not necessarily comfortable with, but I embraced that part of me because it was there and it was useful for that particular time.
Yeah.
And it's something that really comes out in a lot of the Unveiled books, I think, which I'm not going to talk about now, but just when people say, wow, why aren't they having an adult discussion? I'm like, because they're 18.
Yeah.
Because when I was 18, I was incapable of having that adult discussion. And you're asking me this and you're in your mid-20s. You cannot possibly tell me you were that adjusted at 18 because I will not believe you.
Yeah.
And if I, at my age, can say, you know what, I remember that I was not that person at 18, then I'm a little bit sort of about people who are like, yes, well, I would have been like this.
Yeah. I think it also comes with this thing, which is that we're sort of trained to look back on sort of our past when we were teenagers and be like, oh my god, I can't believe I behaved like that. And all I can say is, well done, congratulations, you behaved like a teenager. There's no point getting embarrassed about it. Because, yeah, if you were behaving like that now, it would be a bit weird. But the point is that now, you're not a teenager. Back then, you were. That was part of who you were. It's acceptable for you to do that, because if you hadn't made those mistakes, if you hadn't done those very cringe things, you wouldn't be where you are now. It's all a process.
Absolutely. Far more embarrassing to reach the age of 40 or whatever and still be acting like you're 18 years old. Like, you have no concept of consequences and your effect on other people. In my opinion. Okay, right, let's go on to looking at identity as a storytelling method. So we've laid down some really good groundwork,
mm-hmm.
not rules, but work, for what we understand as a concept of identity and what feeds into it. And we've probably given you a lot of nebulous information because largely it's a nebulous concept. Yeah. But identity is an excellent storytelling vehicle for particularly an internal journey. Mm. So you can have something with lots of action, but the internal journey can also be sort of like... The backup for this entire narrative can be that this person needs to work out who they are or who they want to be. Who they want to be is the big bit, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And this really plays into the hero's journey. And I know that I've mentioned the hero's journey before, but Joseph Campbell's hero's journey actually really sort of ties into this quest for identity. Because the whole concept of the hero's journey is actually an internal one as much as it is an external one. And it's about change, ultimately. It's about developing as a person. But the part of that involves what is essentially self-realization, self-exactualization, whereby the hero faces the thing which holds the most power over them. And, you know, that... if you really look at that, that's a question of identity. That's a question of internally looking at yourself and figuring out what that roadblock is, and ultimately overcoming it, or ultimately understanding it to the point where you kind of are confident with who you are, where you accept who you are, and you become this, you know, it's not that you become a new person, it's that you become yourself unapologetically, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And even when it's really pared down to its bare essentials, and we all know the boy of humble origins handed a sword and a destiny and finally discovers he's a long-lost king or a hero narrative.
Yeah.
Even when it's pared down to that and you don't get a lot of the internal narrative, that's still a quest for identity.
It really is. And usually also because one of the stumbling blocks that they face is the "I don't think I'm worthy."
Yeah.
Which is, again, that's a question of identity. It's a question of I myself don't think that I have what it takes. And then, of course, but you do.
Yes, it's kind of like your best karate is still inside you, Danielson. Oh god, I just quoted Karate Kid 3 and that film is epically crap. But yeah, the point still stands. I sincerely apologise for that one. That just came out of the air.
I'm dying. Oh, sorry.
You're not allowed to die until the end of the episode.
Okay.
But yes, the idea that you're not worthy it is an excellent example.
Yeah,
obviously.
Definitely. I think a really good example of that in a recent thing as well is Moana. Moana actually follows the hero's journey almost exactly. It's amazing. That's why it kind of feels like it's its own mythos story. It's just brilliant. But there's this great moment where Maui has left Moana. She's on her own. She's about to give up. She just doesn't feel like she's worthy. And then she has this kind of realization that connects her with who she is. You know, that's literally the whole song, "I Am Moana," where she goes, This is not, you know, all of my fears and stuff like that. Who I am is the product of nature and my ancestors and my upbringing. And she kind of sees all of it and it all mixes to create her. And she looks at all of these aspects. It's such a proud and significant moment. It moves me every time I see it. I just think that's so fantastically done. And it's a perfect example of someone sort of looking at all aspects that create who they are. That is the real quest of identity. And ultimately, that's what allows her to win in the end.
Yeah, definitely. That's a really good example. Yeah. Obviously, we've basically mentioned like the sword in the stone without actually intending to mention it. So, and everything that's come after that that's imitated it, from sort of Lord of the Rings to, oh, I don't know, pretty much any Arthurian adaptation you like is...
Yeah.
Particularly if they only deal with the first part of it when Arthur's a child or a young boy.
Yeah.
So anyway, we talk about Arthurian myth a lot, so we won't go into
that. None of the shenanigans that happened later on.
Which honestly might have just been... anyway,
so no, we're not.
I'm going to pull myself back there, but I was going to talk about medieval era. No, I'm not going to do it. I can control myself.
See, I almost lured you in there.
You almost did. You almost did. Completely derailed us. Okay. Another method of identity as storytelling. Mm-hmm. The identity of the person is something that either creeps upon them, or they already know on some level, but it must be suppressed, repressed, subverted, or altered in order for them to survive that part of the story. Yeah. So, as an example, there's... I talk about Tamora Pierce a lot, but she is, as I've said before, the gold standard for young adult fiction, has been for many decades now. But there's Trickster's Choice. And the problem for Eily, the main character, is the fact that her mother is this great hero. She was the first female knight in hundreds of years. She became the king's champion despite all the odds. She's not an exceptionally big, well-built individual or anything like that. She's just done it through sheer grit and determination. And Eily's found that very difficult to live up to and doesn't have a very good relationship with her mother. So that definitely plays into her identity.
Yeah.
But Eily also has a very strong sense of identity. She wants to follow in her father's footsteps. Her father is the king's spymaster. It's considered not suitable work for her as a young lady. And then she gets kidnapped by pirates and sold into slavery to the Copper Isles, where she ends up assisting in a rebellion and forming a spy network for the hidden royalty of that particular group, of that particular nation. And it is really interesting because she does have to hide her identity. There are times when, you know, the children she's set to look after when she initially gets sold into slavery are asking her for stories about her homeland, and about, they particularly ask about Alanna the Lioness, who's her mother. And of course Eily's sort of like, oh god, this is a huge part of my identity and I'm going to pretend it's not actually my identity.
Yeah.
And in so doing, she sort of ends up questioning a lot of things, a lot of assumptions and stuff about herself, and becoming more fully who she's supposed to be.
That's very cool. I think an example that immediately comes to mind when I think of sort of repressed identity. And this is one where it's more that there's one aspect that needs to be repressed, and it's Daniel in Trudy Kahneman's The Black Magician trilogy.
Yeah, and it's very definitely repressed, isn't it?
It is.
It's a case of he doesn't even let himself, he's not even aware that he's repressing anything.
Yeah. So Daniel is gay. And what happened was, when he was at the academy, there were rumours flying around that he was gay with another one of the students. And he completely repressed it. And in fact, he used magic to kind of repress it in his own mind. And it's in the second book, he actually is put into a position whereby he has to use all of his magic up. And in doing so... he suddenly catches himself drawing on his magic to get rid of a thought. It's become so frequent that it's subconscious for him. And he suddenly, he realises he's drawing on magic to get rid of, you know, something, you know, this thought that's going on in the back of his mind. But of course there's no magic for him to draw on. And so this thought comes to the front of his mind and he faces who he is, and confesses to the guy that he's with as well, who is also gay. And he comes out and basically says, yeah, and this other student was gay and so was I. And he sort of tentatively starts to pursue this relationship with this guy because where they are, it's okay. But when he gets back to his home town, what happens is that there's a whole bunch of, I'm not going to get into it because it's spoilers, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happening, which whereby he was, it was suggested to him that he pretend to be gay in order to do a bit of spy work. And now he's really worried that he's going to get back and everyone's going to be like, oh, you are actually gay. And it was really interesting because on the one side, his whole journey was the fact that he was coming out, that he was accepting that part of him. But at the same time, his entire sort of external journey has also been about repressing that, having to continue to repress that for his own safety. And it's successful when he does repress it. And I thought that that was a really interesting storyline. Because on the one side, I do want lots of, you know, stories where it's fine if a character's gay. Can we just, hooray, doesn't need to be all trial and error. But for me, yeah. This was really nice because it was about someone coming to terms with who they were, but also having to deal with the reality, which is that a lot of people who are queer or part of the LGBT community do have to repress that part of themselves because of where they live or who they live with. And it was nice to see a balance of someone who was actually repressing it on the outside so that no one found out, but had come to terms with it and was accepting it on the inside.
Yeah, definitely. And it's sort of reflective of the time that that trilogy was written in as well, yeah. Because I think it was late 90s, early noughties. Yeah. As I recall, yeah. 2001. Yeah. So yeah, it, you know, as I said, things have changed at a dramatic pace, yes. And it's not that it's not still an issue today, but that was definitely coming off the back of it had only recently become safe to admit openly you were gay in Weymouth kind of thing without getting your head kicked in. And I'm not exaggerating at all.
No, definitely.
Unfortunately. So yeah, that's a really good example. I've got a similar example. It's The Traitor Baru Cormorant by Seth Dickinson. Mm. And aside from the fact that the whole thing's like an examination of colonialism and economic warfare, Baru herself has come from a polyamorous parental family. So her mother has two husbands, and the husbands are obviously involved as well. Mm. When her land and everything is conquered, what they do is they take the children, educate them in basically the colonial ways. So they learn that it's actually shameful, whereas before it was never shameful. It was just kind of, this is accepted in our culture. Yeah. Something that obviously the British Empire did an awful lot of.
Yeah.
yes, it must just be male, female, and it can only be one of each in any sort of relationship.
Yeah.
Baru herself suspects quite long before you get into it that she might actually be a lesbian. Which is not acceptable. She gets very high up because she's so intelligent. Amongst, you know, one of the things that the imperial forces do and colonialism does very well is when it educates native children, it then takes them on board and uses them as poster children for, you know, this is what a civilizing influence can do.
Yeah, we've civilized the savages. Look what we can do.
Yeah, Baru being very intelligent obviously rises up through the ranks very, very quickly. Mm. Her internal intention is always to bring down the empire from the inside. We won't get into the whole, you know, the fact that she actually becomes the villain that she's trying to defeat thing yet. Mm. But seduced by her own cleverness, it can happen. She has to hide the fact that she is what they would term a trivadist, so a woman who prefers other women.
Yeah.
And at one point, she does this really successfully by getting a man in a situation where she has to blackmail him, mm-hmm. where she is able to blackmail him, and then saying, you know, if you want to survive, then this is what you're going to do. You are going to meet me on these dates, and you're going to let it be known that we are in a relationship. And she's like, I don't actually really want anything to do with you, and I'm not intending to marry you, but I need a beautiful young man so that no rumour is going to follow me around. It was funny and tragic the way that was done. And there are some tragic consequences much later in the book for the fact that she has had to really suppress this side of her identity, which I won't go into, but that is another example for that one. So moving on to a different way that this narrative can be used, the sudden discovery that the main character is not who they thought they were.
Yeah. This is actually quite a popular one.
Yes.
and in some ways
it's built in conflict, isn't it?
It is. It's fantastic. And I, you know, this is one that actually again does appear in The Sword and the Stone, because obviously Arthur doesn't know he isn't who he thought he was. He thought he was just this, you know, this nobody, and then suddenly he's everybody, if that makes sense. But it's been used to even greater effect in a lot of modern stuff.
Particularly when it's an adult discovering that they're not who they thought they were, that basically everything that they've come from, it's almost got more impact that way, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So one example of this is obviously She-Ra.
Yeah.
And we've talked about She-Ra in the past, the idea of being sort of raised, you know, by the enemy instead, being brainwashed, which makes her kind of her whole journey really, really interesting, because obviously she at first really doesn't understand what's going on. And then she has this very extreme reaction where it's suddenly like, well, you've lied to me about this, so you must have lied to me about everything else. So these guys are the good guys, you guys are the bad guys. And then it becomes a little bit more tempered, where she starts to sort of see, actually, there are some bad things that can happen on both sides. Ultimately, yeah, she still decided one side is good and the other side is bad. But she starts to see nuance. But the whole thing with the suddenly my identity has been revealed is that I just can't imagine anything more shocking than to have something just completely switched like that for you, and how discombobulating that must be, and actually how it would probably take some time for the boat to settle, having been rocked so thoroughly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of a bit similar in the Umbrella Academy in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about the series, because I'm afraid I haven't read the graphic novels. Mm. But if you're looking, you're already looking at a set of characters who come from a shaky set of identities, because they were born during this sort of semi-cataclysmic event, and they were born slightly, there's something, they were expected to have something slightly off about them.
Yeah.
They're acquired by an eccentric billionaire who raises them to be his own almost like private team of superheroes.
Yeah.
And so none of them really know where they've come from, other than the fact that they know that their mothers were persuaded to give them up for a sum of cash.
Yeah.
So that's already a very shaky beginning. And then you've got, God, I can't remember her name. I want to say Vanya.
Yeah, Vanya.
It is Vanya. Yeah. Vanya. As you go on, it turns out that I think everybody who knows anything about superheroes can kind of see where that's going, that plot. But it's done really well. Her sense of identity is just constantly being eroded over and over and over again. Mm. Not without reason, but it's horrible the way it's done.
Yeah.
And this eccentric billionaire who wasn't exactly a loving father to any of them.
No.
Has really done some messed up shit with her head. And you could say, did he make it better? Did he just delay the inevitable? Mm. Honestly, I think maybe if he'd sort of just reared her with some affection from the beginning, and rather than assuming that she would never be able to control every, I'm trying not to be too spoilery.
Yeah.
But it's a tough one, but it's a horrible situation. You can't help feeling for her character.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing about the Umbrella Academy is that actually it does really concentrate on the idea of identity. This comes particularly in the fact that, first of all of the characters are numbers. They don't get given names until much later, in which case they are raised by a robot, essentially. Because they keep bringing in nannies and they just keep being chased away. It just doesn't work.
They don't last.
So they create so this billionaire creates a robot instead who raises them. And the very interesting thing about it is that each of them, obviously, they just had numbers, but it's the robot who actually chooses names for them. And the collection of names is actually quite strange until you look at the concept that actually the collection of names, it seems to be that their mother has taken the time, Grace, I think her name is, has taken the time to actually choose names which are appropriate for where they come from. So Diego, for instance, he's obviously Hispanic. He obviously comes from a Latino background. And so you have Diego, and then you have Klaus as well. Vanya. These names have all been chosen, I think, and I can't confirm because we don't actually know where each of them came from, but there is the suggestion that she has taken the time to choose names from the countries where they originated. But of course, they don't actually have any connection with these countries at all. They don't really have any connection with these cultures, with these, you know, with these communities, anything like that. None at all, because they have been raised in what is essentially isolation with one another.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting dynamic in that respect.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the entire show really is about a quest for identity for all of them,
yeah,
to a certain extent, both as a family and as individuals.
Yeah.
It's just, it sort of polarizes in Vanya, doesn't it?
It really does, because obviously Vanya really comes from that repressed identity. And it's the repressed identity, which has not been repressed by her, so she obviously discovers the truth. which is particularly difficult for her because her whole life has been centered on this identity that she was given. She's written a book about it. You know, it's messed up who she is for an incredibly long period of time. And there's a lot of trauma which is linked to that view of her identity, which she's had to live through. So can you imagine going through all of this extreme hardship and then basically being told, hey, it wasn't real?
Yeah. It's sort of, it's the ultimate invalidation of everything you've ever felt,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
This one's going to be a weak comparison, but the Bourne identity.
Yeah.
I mentioned this more because I really enjoyed the idea of sleeper agents. So I could be also talking about something like Dark Angel, which is in a way was terrible, but it was so terrible that I loved it, where you had all these children who were basically lab grown and they were given barcodes, you know, ultimately removing identity. They were genetically manipulated to be stronger, faster, to require less sleep.
Mm.
Etc., etc., with the idea being that they would be weapons once they were grown up.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were genetically engineered to be very beautiful as well, so that, you know, they could be inserted in to positions where they could take out figures of authority without appearing threatening.
Oh.
So, you know, the concept, clearly, that's clearly up my street, isn't
yeah.
it? No wonder I loved it, despite the terrible special effects and the awful dialogue. But yeah, the Bourne identity, again, this is interesting to me because this is somebody who volunteered for a program initially without knowing how they volunteered, without knowing what they were getting into.
Yeah.
Project Treadstone literally imprints this identity over your ordinary run-of-the-mill but top-quality soldier,
yeah,
and turned him into a lethal assassin. And obviously the thing is, he could be triggered on, but apparently after suffering an injury he gets triggered off. And he knows he can do these things, but he's got absolutely no idea who he is.
Yeah.
So it literally becomes a quest for who am I? There's lots of problems with the narrative, and it is a very boys' own adventure, and all the women are accessories, etc., etc., etc. But the central premise is kind of like, yeah, I really like that. That's really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's also the question of, you know, like Bucky Barnes as well with the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
Which sort of follows a very similar thing of who am I and things like that. Obviously, the next one is actually when identity clashes strongly with the accepted norms.
Yeah.
And we have touched on that as well because obviously I mentioned that Daniel, again, from the Black Magician trilogy, where, you know, he had the self, you know, repressed sexuality, which was part of his identity, to the point where he was altering his identity with magic. But also, you know, it's going against the norms, and so he has to repress his identity in order to fit the norms and pretend to be someone that he isn't. Now, bear in mind, again, it's not that he's completely someone he isn't. Sexuality is just one part of your identity, but if you do end up stuffing one part of your identity into a cupboard, then that is a part of you that is missing, and that is a part or a part of you which is being hidden. And I think it is also worth mentioning before we get onto this that actually we do that naturally with one another. We have different faces that we use for different people. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the repression of identity. It just means that the kind of person I am when I'm talking to my, you know, my family is going to be slightly different from the kind of person that I am when I'm talking to my students. That's just natural.
Yeah, it's that thing where there are people in your life who obviously you want them to continue being in your life, but when you actually see them face to face, you feel like you're squeezing back into a skin that's too small for you.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
So without pointing fingers or anything, and it is an uncomfortable experience. It's kind of like, well, I can be this person. I can be all, you know, the fullest version of myself with all these different aspects. Mm. And now I'm basically trying to get my entire body into a sock kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's also what you hope for is that, you know, the person, your significant other and that your family are the ones who can see every single part of you. But I wouldn't come out swinging with that, you know, to certain people. Like, the person I can be in front of my brother is going to be very different from the person I can be in front of my grandfather. It's you know, even within family, there's I'm not gonna come in. Like, if I came into a room with my brother, I could shout, "I'm hella gay today." He wouldn't bat an eyelid. If I did that to my grandfather, first of all, he wouldn't hear me. But if he did, I think he... Anyway, the point is that that's very natural. And there's a difference between sort of changing or being a slightly different person depending the company that you're in. Because I think it's also quite an ask to be every single part of who you are at every single moment with every single person. That would be exhausting for everybody involved. But there is a difference between doing that and repressing part of your identity in order to be safe, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So just a book example for this one, which I won't go too much into, but When the Moon Was Ours by Anna Marie Macklemore. They have recently come out as NB.
Right.
When they wrote the book, they identified as female. Mm-hmm. So if I slip, I'm very sorry. I'll do my best. But the book itself is about two young people growing up in Mexico, or, you know, in that sort of area. And one of them is a trans male character who has lived his life as a Bacapulche. I talked about that before. Bacapulche is a Middle Eastern custom whereby if a family does not have a son in order to sort of carry on the male tradition side of the families, then one of the girls might be dressed and raised as a boy.
Right.
Which is apparently acceptable all the way up until they sort of hit puberty. And then it becomes the time when they're expected to then regrow their hair long and put on dresses and adopt female mannerisms and be subservient to men. Mm. The reason they do this is so that the sisters can be escorted by a male member of the family and thus be protected, etc. And that they can have a boy in the family, even if they don't actually have a physical boy, to run errands and things, which the girls would not be allowed to do. Mm-hmm. This causes huge problems for, you know, even girls who've been dressed as Bacapulche who are not, who are not trans, who don't discover that actually they really do feel that they're male. Simply because there's hundreds and thousands of ways to be a girl, and all they're being told is you have to go back to being a girl in this specific way that you do not identify with at all. So that's already quite a big issue. In this instance, this was a trans character, and his mother saw that he was male very early on in his life and adopted the custom, and then obviously sort of moved over to Mexico, and they kept him as he kept the identity of being a male all the way up through school, except obviously things started to change and then the secret kind of came out a little bit and it caused a lot of problems. On the other side, there's his girlfriend, who started off as his best friend, who literally doesn't know where she came from. Mm. A water tower fell one night over the fields, and she fell out of the water tower.
Wow.
As a small child. And he was the first person, as a very small boy, who approached her and, you know, took her hand and said, "You're going to be all right." And they were best friends ever since. So it's really, really cute. But it's also a case of she genuinely doesn't know where she's come from. So this is two people both seeking identity, and both of them well outside the norms. And there's lots of magical stuff and witchcraft and things going on as well. So it's a magical realism book. It is excellent. It's really good. And, you know, I think if you want to read a piece of fiction that sort of engages what it can be like for somebody, if you're on the outside like me and you want to read a piece of fiction that wants to engage what it's like to be trans, mm-hmm. I think that helps. Anna Marie McLemore's husband is trans, so they have come, and obviously they've just come out as NB non-binary. Yeah. So, you know, they are coming from the perspective of understanding what they're talking about, yeah. and doing it in a way that's respectful and very beautifully written as well.
Mm. Yeah. I'm not going to talk about it too much, but this is also something that I did a little bit in Blood of the Delphi. Similar kind of setup, in so much as what, you know what, I'm just going to give spoilers because at this point, the character Daniel, who is Zachary's little brother, is trans. So one of the character is trans, and that is Daniel. And Daniel's situation was that when he was first born, he was disguised as a boy. Because his mother was worried that Rivelin, the father, would kill Daniel if he thought Daniel was a girl. Because Rivelin had so many daughters at this point, he'd made an offhand comment that if he had another one, he'd throw them down a well or something like that. This wouldn't have actually been the case, probably, maybe. Well, we don't know.
He's father of the year.
Yeah, definitely father of the year. But Isolde basically went, fine, I will disguise what she thought then was her daughter as a boy until I can gather enough money for us to escape. Which was also fine and easy because Rivelin wasn't exactly very sort of involved, particularly when Daniel was very young. The problem was, Daniel was actually a boy. And very quickly, Isolde, who's not exactly the nicest person, she's actually not a good person in the least at all, like, seriously, but recognised that her son was actually a son. And instead of running away, allowed Daniel to be a son whilst supporting him. And one of the sort of core aspects that Daniel sort of goes through is that Daniel right now is going through the Magi. This is a Magi Academy and wants to be a Magi. As far as Daniel is concerned, there has never been another trans Magi. Of course, who knows? But it's incredibly nerve-wracking because he also realises that at any moment, if he's discovered, his father will likely kill him. And that, you know, he will be in a terrible position. At the very least, there's no way that he can be a Magi if he's discovered. So it's very much he has to keep it quiet. And at the same time, he's going through this whole thing with Zachary. And again, this sort of starts to play in also into this sense of identity, which is that there starts to be this question of whether Rivelin is actually his father or whether Zachary is his father. And this actually is significant in him trying to figure out who he is. And he comes out to Zachary, who doesn't understand, really, to be honest. No. He doesn't understand at all. But he sort of goes, I guess there are weirder things. And over time, he'll sort of start to learn and he'll figure it out. But Zachary, in his very typical, I don't understand, says possibly the wrong thing or makes a joke out of it, but ultimately accepts that Daniel is a boy. And part of the rest of Daniel's journey is basically really becoming confident in that and recognizing that being transgendered is part of his identity and part of what he's been through, because he's not going through the experience of going through the academy as a cisgendered boy. He's going through the experience as a transgendered boy, which is obviously very different. And so that identity is very relevant to him. And even though it's not an entire part of who he is, it's pretty significant at this time because he has to repress it on several levels.
Yeah. I did touch a little bit on a similar theme in I Hold the Tide, which, again, won't go into in any depth, but what I was doing was exploding the idea, hopefully, that historically there have never been any trans individuals.
So. Yeah. I love the fact that there's literally written examples of trans individuals in the Roman Empire, and everyone's like, no, nope, they were just crazy. And you're like, shut up.
No. So, I mean, this is, I'm not going to say this is going to be my thing, because I don't want to turn it into a unique selling point, but there's going to be, whenever I write something, there's going to be a reflection of all levels of life. I'm determined to be, because I am honestly sick of the same old stories being told in the same old ways. The same old ways is the part that bothers me, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there are some things that we want to be retold over and over again. It's the question of how you retell them, really. To erase people from history, to erase entire identities from history, it really starts to mess up with people's modern identities. To say, oh, this is just a new fad, we never had trans people before, like, shut up. Yes, we did.
Yeah, we absolutely did. Right, okay, so this is an interesting one, I find. Another key character's identity turns out to be false, thus shaking the identity of the main character. So I know that's a bit more of a nuanced version of you're not who you thought you were, but I think that's different. That's the whole sort of suddenly discovering at age 18 or 21 that you're adopted and you don't know who your real family are.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is when someone else does it and there's this kind of reflection. This is quite an interesting one because it's like doubly internal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it is. A good example for me is Shauna Maguire's October Day series. October Day, or Toby, is a changeling. So she's half human and half fairy. There you go, managed to get the F word in.
Yay!
She believes, but, you know, she's very weak even for a changeling. Spoilers, people. I'm sorry, because I need to go into this, I'm going to spoilify Toby's sort of main character arc in this respect. But she believes that her mother is Dunyashi. The Dunyashi have various different talents, but one of them is being able to track people through their blood. Right. Or rather, sort of to the blood. You know, they can tell things. So if she tastes, she starts off as a private investigator, as so many of these urban fantasy characters do. And what gives her the edge is the fact that if she tastes a murder victim's blood, then she can tell something about their last moments. She sees what they see. It's a horrible experience, riding the blood. As you get further and further along into the series, Toby realises that the balance of her blood has been subtly altered. In fact, it's been swayed as far towards human as it's possible for it to be, and yet have her still being fairy, and still being part of the land of fairy. Someone's messed with the balance of her blood. And then you get a bit further on into the book again, and various other things happen, and she realises that not only has her mother lied to her mother's not Dunyashi at all, her mother's Dolkashi. Dolkashi are blood-manipulating fairies, so they have some of the same characteristics, but the reason that Toby's so crap at things like glamours and things like that, which are like Dunyashi staples, is the fact that she's not the species she thought she was. Dokashe can change the balance of your blood. The thing with fairy is, yes, lots of species are co-compatible when it comes to mating, but it's a bad idea to mix too many blood strains because it tends to lead to fairy madness. What Dokashe can do is rebalance the blood so that they can basically set the different natures fighting within someone's own blood, their own genetics, if you like. They can rebalance it so that they can either remove a strain completely, just make them one thing.
Yeah.
Toby's mother had been experimenting on her even as a very small child and shifting her blood gradually more towards human. She wanted to make Toby into a completely human child rather than a changeling so that she would have this human pet to play with and then forget about when she'd grown up.
Oh, great.
Her mother is one of the most terrible mothers in fiction. She's really, really awful. And also sort of classically fairy in the sense of, yes, this interested me for a while, so I played fairy bride and I got a human man to fall in love with me and I married him, etc., etc. And I had a changeling child and then I got bored of the whole situation and walked away and didn't explain anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, poor Toby's kind of left working all of that out and she learns to change the balance of her own blood slightly, but she's still at the moment, as we are on book 14, clinging to a tiny little vestige of humanity. Although she knows that one day she'll probably have to cross the line completely and erase her human blood completely.
That's really interesting. What a fascinating concept.
Yeah, it's a really interesting take on the whole sort of who am I? It's a case of, am I even the species I thought I was? Oh yeah, and by the way, my mother's even worse than I thought.
Fun times.
Definitely.
Okay, so what about a change of identity which is forced on the main character by, you know, manipulation or by some sort of magic or science resulting in them gaining knowledge from another point of view or reclaiming an identity or etc.?
This, weirdly, is the subsection I kind of most wanted to talk about. I think this is largely because I want to talk about The Last Unicorn.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, I know what she wants to talk about, because she wants to talk about the thing that traumatized her when she was a child. She wants to talk about The Last Unicorn.
Which, you know, by the way, I still love. I'm still like a Last Unicorn collector. apparently I have very troubled relationships with things that traumatize me. Basically, again, spoilers, so guys, I'm sorry if you haven't read the book or seen the film, but you know, it has been out for well over 30 years now, even longer for the book. In The Last Unicorn, the entire story is a quest for identity. One day, The Last Unicorn is in her woods, which she keeps sort of spring, summertime, all year round, because she's there and she's a magical creature. And she hears two hunters talking, and one of them says that, yeah, the reason that this forest is the way it is, the reason game is so hard to catch here, is because it's a unicorn's forest, and this is the absolute last unicorn in the world. And as they ride off, she sort of comes forward and says, I'm the last, I'm the only one, and she genuinely can't remember ever having seen another unicorn, because they're generally a solitary species. They're sort of born, and then they find their niche in the world, and then they live there quite happily, just sort of keeping everything going and, you know, blessing the fountains and the rivers and things, etc. And she's kind of like, I have to leave the forest. I have to go out and find if there are other unicorns in the world. So this massively shakes up the status quo and her sense of identity as a unicorn, obviously, to find out, is she actually the last of her species? So that's what her quest is. She's looking for other unicorns. But it's been such a long time that people don't even recognise her when they see her. They just see a strange looking white horse.
Yeah.
And she gets captured and kidnapped and drugged and all sorts of, I mean, that sounds awfully like trafficking, but it's honestly not. She ends up getting captured and put in a cage as part of a carnival.
Yeah.
Which throws her into the path of a magician called Shmendrick, who is actually not a very good magician at all.
He's trying.
He's trying. They escape, and then she meets another woman who's kind of been persuaded by ballads of Robin Hood and things to go off and live the life amongst the merry men, except it's not really a life she likes all that much.
No.
She's now sort of like in her mid-30s and has got to the stage where she doesn't think there's any magic left in the world. And the band of men capture Shmendrick, and then the unicorn comes forward to rescue him because she's decided, yes, she needs him for her quest. And this woman, Molly Grew, sort of just flies into a rage at the unicorn, sort of, how dare you turn up now when I'm heading towards middle age? Why didn't you come when I was a young girl before everything sort of went wrong and was ruined, etc.? I have to admit, I didn't understand that as a child, but I get it now. Not the whole sort of the whole sort of having to overcome the fact that there was no magic and you'd reconciled yourself to it, and then suddenly magic is presented to you.
Yeah, I remember the first time I came across it was the movie, and that whole outburst where she just ends up crying in the end.
Yeah,
it always really moved me because it just felt so desperate and so sad.
Yeah, and I suppose you could say that both of those characters are also, by extension, on a quest for their own identity, because Molly wants to get back something of who she was. She's lost her magic.
Yeah.
Her sense of magic, her sense of wonder in the world.
Yeah.
And the presence of the unicorn helps to heal that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it turns out all the other unicorns have been gathered up by King Haggard. Great name. And his ghostly red bull, who drove them into the sea. And obviously the unicorns haven't died. They're immortal creatures. But they're too frightened to come out of the sea because the red bull is allowed to pace. So Haggard has, being the miser he is, has taken all the unicorns in the world, apart from one, the one he missed. And he looks down at the sea from his horrible, dismal castle and sort of, like, gloats over the fact that he basically owns all the unicorns.
Yeah.
Which is a very disturbing concept, if you think about it.
Very disturbing.
Somehow, the unicorn has to save them all. But Haggard sort of releases the bull, and the bull comes after her. And again, she's as frightened of the bull as all her fellows had been. Mm. And in a desperate bid, Schmendrick turns her into a woman. And that's the point we're getting to. So I'm sorry about the preamble, but I thought that bit was interesting as well. But suddenly, she's not an immortal creature anymore. She's an immortal creature forced into a mortal body. She doesn't understand how humans act. She doesn't understand these human emotions that have been foisted onto her. And then it goes through the bit that really traumatised me as a child. Instead of turning her straight back into a unicorn, Schmendrick's like, no, I can do it when I need to. But she's better off as a woman because the bull can't recognise her.
Yeah.
So we can get into Haggard's castle and find out where the unicorns are, because they don't know they're in the sea at that point.
Yeah.
And it all goes horribly wrong because she starts to forget that she's an immortal creature, and she falls in love with Haggard's adopted son, Leah.
Yeah.
And again, hated that bit as a child. I was like, no, she's supposed to be a unicorn. And I think the bit that still sort of gives me echoes of horror to this day is the idea of being something you are and really genuinely knowing what you are, even if you don't understand all the implications of that, and then someone taking that away from you and pushing you into a form that isn't yours.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was any deliberate trans metaphor there, but you can certainly read it that way nowadays if you want to.
Yeah, definitely. I think you really, really can. And I think it also really, as a trans metaphor, it is very interesting because it's the idea that you can actually lie to yourself to a certain extent where you erase those parts of your identity. But the fact of the matter is that they don't actually disappear. They don't go away. They're just being repressed. It's not healthy. It's not right. And so, you know, it explains why, you know, you can have the situation where gay men in particular, or gay women get married and then years later suddenly turn around and go, I can't stay with you anymore because actually I'm not straight. I'm gay. I've always been gay. I've just been repressing it. And it's also why, you know, you can have trans people who come out later in life who you know, there's lots of individuals who realise or who come out when they're very young, but it doesn't mean that you're wrong if suddenly you kind of get to the age of 30 even and turn around and say, actually, I am not cisgendered.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it same sort of being, if you can be a sort of bang in the middle bisexual and just ignore half of your life in that respect.
Yeah.
In, it doesn't happen, it didn't happen, it's not important. Or even, you know, the greatest of lies, it was a phase.
Oh.
Kind of thing. And what you really are is the other half of this thing, rather than sort of, you're both. You've always been both, and it's okay to not be on either side, kind of thing. That's a gross oversimplification with both, because what I really mean is all, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think obviously The Last Unicorn ends with her going back to being a unicorn, having learnt what it really means to be human. And yeah. she knows she's supposed to be a unicorn, I think, is the thing.
Yeah.
But she's a unicorn that now experiences human emotions and understands regret.
Yeah.
And that's really bittersweet. And yes, all the other unicorns get released out into the world, but she has to carry the cost of what she's done.
Yeah. It was, the ending always really made me very sad. Because it felt like, yeah, this is a, she has a split identity now, and she's never going to recover from it. And this is a case, again, for that argument of trauma actually becoming part of your identity. And you can actually look back on life and say, I wish I could be the person that I was before this happened. But you can't, because you can't erase what has happened, and you can't erase the fact that it will have changed who you are, and it is now part of your identity, even if it was a horrific thing that happened. That's not to say that it should have happened, or that you should be glad that it happened, or that, you know, that the person you are now is, you know, enough of, is equal to the cost of what occurred. It's just inevitable, and it can't be ignored.
I always found it interesting that at the end, when she's having her last conversation with Shmendrick, she says, no sadness can dwell in me while that joy exists. She's talking about the fact that unicorns are in the world again. And then she says, save one, but I thank you for that part too. So even though there's this horrible traumatic thing, and she's not a mortal creature who's free to love a human, and she will, all part of her will always be mortal. She says, part of me is mortal yet. She actually says she thanks him for it because it's given her a greater understanding despite the cost.
Yeah. And that's where, hopefully, I have to bring it up. It makes me think of something that a lot of people got really annoyed about in Game of Thrones, where Sansa basically says, well, if I hadn't gone through all the experiences that I went through, I wouldn't be who I was now. And a lot of people got very, rightfully, very annoyed about it, saying, why is it, you know, why? It just sort of makes it sound like she's saying, but it's okay that I was raped and sexually assaulted and physically assaulted and abused.
And just because, passed around like that.
Yeah.
As though I had no value.
Yeah. Because if I hadn't been, I wouldn't be as strong as I was today. And the fact of the matter is that there is a truth to that, because if she hadn't had those experiences, she wouldn't have shaped into the person that she was today. But that doesn't make those experiences right. And it feeds into this massive trope, which is that a huge part of female identity when explored in media relies on the idea of, like, well, to be truly a strong female, to have that kind of identity, you've got to have been sexually assaulted.
Yeah, that, I think it was problematic in the way it was done there, simply because that was not a great line of dialogue to really encompass a huge, what, eight seasons worth of things that had happened, of experience. So, sort of, if it hadn't been for that and all the rest, I would have remained a little bird forever. And it's kind of like, okay, you don't get to sum all of that up in one line.
Yeah.
And that could have been more sensitively handled, definitely. Because it did annoy me at the time.
Whereas, yeah, and it absolutely annoyed me too. I just thought, oh, wow, really?
But yeah, you're right. There is definitely a truth in it. And I kind of feel that it was more balanced with the last bit of The Last Unicorn, because at least she was saying it from a position of, I understand things better now. She hadn't been, like, sexually assaulted or anything. She
and that's that's exactly what I mean, is that in The Last Unicorn, that's where you can sort of, the metaphor ends, in that I think it was done sensibly. It's not the same thing at all. And the reason I highlight it is because so often, you know, that is the storyline for women, for female characters. It's often the storyline for trans female characters as well. And for, you know, gay characters, is that they have to have been, had to have had some kind of abuse. They have to have been through awful, terrible things in order to be who they are now. Which means that when that doesn't happen, it can be equated. So someone could watch The Last Unicorn, and again, this is not how I saw it, but I can see how it could be done, and say, hold on a second, this is someone who, against their will, had their body changed, was forced into certain experiences, and has now been marked by it, and yet they're saying thank you for that experience. Which in some ways, a lot of the time, people are like, well, I'm thankful I went through that horrific experience, because if I hadn't, I wouldn't be who I am today. And it's like, that's not how that works.
No, definitely.
You don't need to be thankful for your trauma, for it resulting in you becoming a stronger person. You don't need to be thankful for it. And that's often the story that's given. And it links this idea of identity, the current person you are now, being, you know, that you should be thankful for all the things that led you to be the person that you are now. You don't have to be thankful for all of those parts which led to the identity that you have now. But you don't need to be thankful for those things to accept who you are now, and to understand who you are now, and to even like who you are now.
Yeah. On a more humorous note, but one that actually has quite a deadly serious under theme, this is a very 90s film. It's called Virtual Sexuality, and it features a fairly young Paul Bettany wearing unfortunately a terrible orangey tan, because apparently they decided that was what was needed. It's about a girl who, she's 17 and she's really in her head about what she's supposed to look like, and yeah, when she's supposed to have lost her virginity, and etc.
Yeah.
And she's trying to find a way of doing it so that it's kind of like coming of age, but she's grasping for things without asking herself whether she really needs them.
Yeah.
Anyway, she goes with one of her sort of friends, her male friend, to this science fiction or a sci-fi type game convention thing. And whilst there, she goes into a booth that basically it gives you a computer. It looks, you know, the effects look really clunky now because that's mid-90s for you. But she goes into this booth and it sort of gives you an idealized version of yourself. So it's kind of like a pre-surgery thing, things that you could change. Mm-hmm. And she's playing around with it, and she's kind of like, yeah, I don't know if I'd change that or whether I would or what have you. And then she makes a male version of herself, and then she turns this male version of herself into her idealized male version, and she's kind of like, oh yeah, that's definitely it. And this is obviously who Paul Bettany plays. There's a power surge, the machine goes horribly wrong and basically creates a doppelganger, a male doppelganger of her. So, but you don't find out it's a doppelganger till much later. It's part of her inside a male body, and she ends up sort of, to start off with, running around male, very good looking and naked, sort of like, oh shit, I need to, that was it, her clothes don't really fit anymore. She's like, these heels don't fit, what the hell happened to my feet? So that's it. It is very, very funny, but it also, I think, really highlights the idea of identity and looks, particularly for women, the idea that you need to be this idealized version of yourself. Yeah. And that men are some sort of rite of passage that need to be conquered rather than seeing them as human beings. And the same works in reverse as well, particularly nowadays.
Yeah.
Anyway, she ends up staying with her friend at a friend's house, this male guy. So uh-huh. she's there she is, trapped in a male body, this idealized male body that's getting a lot of female attention already, with her nerdy little friend. And he's the one who genuinely believes it's like, okay, I know you're Justine trapped in a male body, and this is all really, really weird and everything. And as the whole thing goes on and they try to work out a plan to like put the two spliced bits of her back together again, she starts to understand the male perspective a bit more, the decent male perspective, not the absolute dumpster fire trash male perspective.
Yay.
And then she's kind of, basically, the film is still very funny. It's probably aged a little bit, but I will say it's worth watching. You get to the end of the film and she's much more chilled with herself. She's kind of like, no, I have value beyond this, and men see you as having, the men who are worthwhile see you as having value beyond just, you know, just having the right body shape or the right hair or being willing to have sex. And it's a really sort of healthy message towards the end about, you know, you don't have to do things on somebody else's timeline. You don't have to look a certain way. You can be comfortable with you and someone will still value you if they're worth valuing in turn.
That's cool. I think that's also that's a really good message to give to a lot of young women.
So it, as I said, the effects are a little bit clunky now, but it's an extremely amusing film. And I think it also, the reason it resonated for me is the fact that it underlines the idea that there are hundreds of different ways to be a girl.
Yeah.
The last one, we don't really need to necessarily go into it. Maybe that's one for another episode, actually, looking at it. But it's the whole idea of coming of age drama. And in speculative fiction, you can have a group of teenage characters and there's all this bullshit going on in the background. But the story is really about the fact that teenagers are learning who they are in order to become adults.
Yeah. It's very, very popular. And obviously it makes a lot of sense that in YA fiction, this really is prominent because weirdly enough, one of the main things that a lot of teenagers are facing is questions of identity, figuring out who they are. I can completely, and this is completely relevant, obviously, because this is people who are suddenly developing their own personalities. They're getting out from underneath the shadow of their parents, you know, the control of their parents. And I say control, I don't mean that in a malicious way. I mean that, you know, when you're younger, your parent says, right, bedtime, and that's it. You know, you are completely sort of working within sort of their routine. In some ways, you're almost an extension of them. And then you start to gain your kind of your own independence. And then as a teenager, you start to gain your own independence in school as well. And you really start to push through. And so there is suddenly this question of who am I as an individual? Not just who am I in terms of part of this family, part of this group in school, etc., but me as an individual. And that's really when the question starts. So of course it appears in a lot of YA. It's very popular, and I honestly do think we could have an entire episode about it.
Yeah, we can. But just as a one example, which again we won't go into because we could do another episode on this, is The Rest of Us Just Live Here by Patrick Ness.
Yeah.
Which obviously Madeline brought up in a previous episode and I then read, and it is almost a pitch perfect rendition of a coming of age story set against a very distant backdrop of the world ending or some other weird shit going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is perfect because it does look at actually the difficulties of identity and growing up and how these two things are linked, particularly if all you've ever known is your family life and your school life, and then suddenly you're heading off to university, which is where people go a bit crazy.
Yeah, they certainly can do.
Obviously, we've used the question of identity in both of our writing, and we've mentioned it already, but I think particularly for Jules, who obviously you write a lot of YA, it's therefore very prominent, I think.
Yeah, and obviously as I touched on earlier, a lot of that is a case of, well, how did I think and feel when I was 18? And I suppose that's also why I've got a lot of secondhand embarrassment type stuff going on there. I think the characters probably handle things in a slightly more healthy manner. But yeah, the awkwardness and the sheer, oh God, I don't know, I genuinely don't really know where the boundaries are because I don't know where my own limits are.
Mm. Yeah, that really comes through. For me, it's what makes their relationship feel real, all of the characters' relationships, and why arguments can happen over silly things. Because, you know, as a reader, you watch it and you're like, why are you arguing? Just communicate! But the reality is that teenagers are really dramatic.
And there's so much more at stake. It can be a tiny thing. It can be a tiny thing sort of like, well, I don't want to give away power. I've realised this is a power play, but I just haven't quite vocalised that to myself or internalised it. So I don't want to be the person to show my underbelly for reaching for your hand first. And it can turn into a huge thing.
Yeah, it really can. I think there's also another aspect which happens with the teenager side of it, which is that... And this is something that I can't even remember where I heard about it, which is that we inherit our parents' trauma. And the problem is that we inherit our parents' trauma, but we don't ever really understand what's causing it or why, which can be a big part of it. And one thing as a teenager, I think, is that particularly for M, for instance, she has inherited a lot of things that are coming from her family and her family situation. And in some ways, she's inherited them, like, literally. Kieran, as well, is a fantastic example. where there is a lot of trauma that is being inherited down the line. which means that, yeah, suddenly you're, not only are you trying to tackle who you are as a person, but part of that is tackling who your parents are as well. And who your family are and who what your background is. I obviously also touch on that in The Sons of Festian at the end, spoiler alert, where Rufus suddenly realises that he's not who he thought he was. His mother is someone, which just also means that...
Say, you pulled an absolute classic, didn't you, there? Yeah, by the book, almost.
really did, just right at the end, and suddenly like, hey, you know that person you've been trying to protect because he's your best friend? He's actually your brother. He has been the entire time. And also, not only are you actually related to, not only are you Adelphi, your dad is the one who's responsible for all of the stuff that's happened. You know that murder that triggered all of this? Guess who's responsible? Right, take this baby and go out into the world.
So, but no pressure or anything.
No pressure. Hope you know who you are now. Bye-bye! Which is also why, sort of in book two, including a lot of the trauma that he has, considering he's also a child of Arimathea, he develops like a second personality in some ways. His subconscious sort of, he starts to hallucinate, actually, and the subconscious sort of starts to appear to him in various forms, because he starts to really struggle with who he is, what his role is, what he's supposed to do, particularly because he feels like he's sort of failed in every single role that he has and who he is, and he doesn't really kind of want to continue living anymore, and he's very worried that actually deep down he's a bad person, and that he can't control that for much longer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, identity is fun.
It certainly can be an excellent driving force for the internal part of your narrative, or even the external. You can, you know, it both can come from the same place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are going to have to draw to a close here.
Yeah, definitely.
Of course, we'd like to invite our readers to share their thoughts on the question of identity. Can you think of any great examples of stories which really touched on this theme or topic? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? How important is the quest for identity to you guys in fiction? Do let us know. Leave us a comment. Remember, you can contact us on Twitter, on Facebook, or on Tumblr, or you can email us individually. We'd love to hear from you. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
Yes. last night, Alan and I, this is actually quite an appropriate one, we watched a film called Dating Amber.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in 1995 in Ireland. And basically, you have the two main characters, a girl and a boy. The girl's lesbian, the boy is gay, but not quite okay with it yet. And right. They decide that they're fed up of the slurs they're constantly getting at school. So they decide they're going to be an item until the end of the school year, just to get everyone off their back.
Yeah, I think I've seen trailers for it. It does look hilarious.
It's funny, it's poignant, and I think it engages with the subject matter in a really intelligent way. It doesn't make out that this is the best way to handle things, but as someone who obviously was a teenager in the mid-90s, I'm like, yeah, actually that genuinely is how I remember it being, as in it wasn't necessarily sort of like the mid-80s for being gay, but at the same time, it wasn't a case of, yeah, whatever, your sexuality is your sexuality, nobody's really mind. It was a case of, oh god, well, can't get too close to you, I might catch it. You know, you did get slurs thrown at you. That was a lot of my experience at that time as well.
Yeah.
And obviously other people I knew. So, yeah, and Ireland as well, at that time in the mid-90s, it was a really lonely time to be gay in Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how they do it is, there's just some beautiful moments there as well, and particularly with the boy who is really coming to terms with the fact that he's gay and he doesn't actually want to join the army like his father wants him to,
yeah,
even if he is good enough. And the girl is kind of like, yeah, she's got a strong sense of what her identity is and that she's a lesbian, but she doesn't necessarily want to confront it. She just wants to get out of the town because, you know, there's been things with her family, and she's blaming the town, the small town attitude for everything. And they end up having this really, really lovely friendship.
Aww.
Which obviously faces challenges and they have arguments and stuff, but it is great. It's very funny and it is pitch perfect for the time period it's set in as well. It's well worth watching.
Fantastic. That's brilliant. Well, we'll say thanks very much for listening, guys. We hope everybody is keeping well and safe. And yeah, we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.